It's Wednesday, April 24th, and in a world without Roe, can a state really ban every abortion? We start here. The Supreme Court prepares to hear a landmark case challenging one of the most stringent laws in the nation.
A federal law here does conflict with Idaho's law and other states' laws.
Could there, in fact, still be a kind of national right to abortion? We'll preview the arguments. The FBI stumbled when they needed it the most.
Their failures allowed over 100 children to continue being abused.
Now, the victims of Larry Nassar are getting a massive settlement. And Walmart promised to recycle your plastic bags, but did they know it was going here?
9,000 miles away in Indonesia and Malaysia.
Our team investigates why your plastic might end up in a poor community on the other side of the world. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Most Democrats thought Florida was pretty much out of play this election cycle. In recent years, the state has turned a pretty reliable shade of red. But yesterday, President Biden arrived there for a campaign event, and he seemed fired up.
It'll be all of us who restore those rights for women in America.
See, the difference between a few years ago and right now is the end of Roe v. Wade. In fact, specifically, about a month from now, Florida is set to enact a state ban on abortions past 6 weeks of pregnancy, which, since most women don't know they're pregnant by then, is effectively a ban on all abortions.
I don't think we're going to let them get away with it, do you?
No!
This plan is so radical that Democrats now think they can maybe, just maybe, carry the state at the polls, because they think by November, voters will have a better sense of how impactful and lasting these abortion restrictions will be. In fact, later today, the U.S. Supreme Court is about to hear a case that could define just how far states can go. Big day ahead of us. Let's start with Kate Shaw. She's a law professor at UPenn. She's also an ABC News Supreme Court contributor. Kate, what is the significance of this case in Washington today?
Brad, it's a really significant case, I think, both for actual pregnant women in states with really restrictive abortion laws, but also for giving us a sense of really what this post-Roe landscape is going to look like in the coming years. So this case is about emergency rooms and medical care for people in crisis. So actually, people experiencing healthy pregnancies, this case isn't about that at all. What this case is about is if a woman presents at an emergency room in a state like Idaho, which is where this case is out of, that has very, very restrictive abortion laws, but where federal law requires the ER to provide stabilizing care to a woman in crisis, essentially which body of law controls? Idaho has a very restrictive law that basically says abortions are only permitted to save a patient's life, and there is a rape exception, but a narrow one. But federal law says in emergency rooms where hospitals receive federal funds, if a person's health is threatened by a medical emergency, the doctors have to provide whatever appropriate care is necessary to preserve the patient's life and their health. And if that care involves performing an abortion, then federal law protects doctors' ability to perform those abortions. So we have a conflict. Idaho says no abortions, essentially unless the patient is at death's door. But federal law says if the doctor thinks an abortion is necessary to prevent major organ failure or impairment of future fertility or other very serious health threats, then the doctor is permitted to perform the abortion. So the question is which body of law controls.
I see. Because when Roe v. Wade went away, it's like there's no more standard for abortions in this country at a federal level. You're saying there still could be a standard of care for women, and maybe that involves an abortion.
Right. Before Dobbs overturned Roe versus Wade, the federal constitution protected some right to access abortion. When Roe went away, states had essentially free rein to restrict or even to prohibit abortion in the way that Idaho has done. But there are other bodies of law that remain intact, and a federal law here does conflict with Idaho's law and other states' laws. And so the stakes for individuals who have high-risk pregnancies, who might find themselves in some kind of crisis and might need to seek emergency room care, are incredibly high. But beyond this particular case, this is a reminder that when Dobbs said the abortion question is going to be left to the states, each state can decide for themselves what to do about abortion, that was never really a settlement that was going to hold. And why people travel from one state to another, individuals access hospitals that are constrained by federal rules and regulations. So this kind of state-by-state solution was never going to be a particularly durable one. But I do think that a majority of this court is very, very skeptical of protection for abortion. We saw that on display in the Dobbs opinion. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a chance that the court could rule against the federal government and in favor of Idaho, which I think would, you know, subject individuals in this post-Dobbs landscape to potentially more uncertainty and vulnerability about their ability to access needed medical care.
Well, and which brings my mind back to what I was mentioning earlier with President Biden and how Democrats think that this is this galvanizing force. And I know that you think about the law. I know justices are supposed to be above petty electoral politics, but clearly this is a centerpiece of a campaign year now. So, I mean, will the political landscape play a role in court today?
I think it's entirely possible. So the court actually has two big abortion cases it's considering this term. Today's case about emergency care, but also the case about mifepristone, the medication abortion drug.
Right.
And I imagine that the justices are thinking to a degree about the election year backdrop that they are operating against. So I think that with the mifepristone case, I think there is a real chance the justices will dismiss that case on standing grounds. And I think that's legally correct. But I also think it might be influenced by their awareness of the likely, you know, seismic consequences it would have if the Supreme Court really severely restricted access to mifepristone. So I don't think they're going to be completely oblivious to the election year background. It seems possible that if the court here rules for Idaho and rules in favor of a very restrictive abortion law, then that too could, you know, at least on the margins, increase the salience of abortion as an election year issue and potentially benefit the Democrats. And that's something the justices may well be aware of.
Yeah, it's like the overarching message here is if you thought you were done thinking about federal abortion policy, think again, because we know that women's health and abortion intersect in many, many ways, according to doctors. So, Kate Shaw, big case today. Thank you so much for teeing it up.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the FBI waited to investigate Larry Nassar, and now you're paying for it. We're back in a bit. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. Dr. Larry Nassar was convicted in 2018.
You do not deserve to walk outside of a prison ever again.
Remember, this was a doctor who worked for USA Gymnastics and, for decades, sexually abused athletes under the guise of keeping them healthy. In 2018, many of these gymnasts were able to watch Nassar be sentenced.
And while we all are moving mountains, you, Larry, we'll have no choice but to sit in prison and wait to die.
However, that's not where the story ends, because Nassar, they said, was not the only one who failed them.
To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar. And I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse.
They spoke out about gymnastics officials and coaches, but also law enforcement. Because remember, some of these gymnasts had been reporting this behavior for years.
The FBI and others within both USAG and USOPC knew that Nasser molested children and did nothing to restrict his access.
What is the point of reporting abuse if our own FBI agents are going to take it upon themselves to bury that report in a drawer?
Well, yesterday, the Department of Justice agreed to settle with more than 100 victims over the action, or should I say, lack of action by the FBI. ABC's Alex Mallon covers the Justice Department. Alex, this was a huge settlement, right? What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, and Brad, it was really years in the making. The Justice Department announced yesterday that it had reached a $138.7 million settlement in order to resolve roughly 140 claims that were brought forward by women, female athletes who said they were abused by Larry Nassar. And I think that the key here is this is, you know, separate from the reporting system that they went through to go to the USA Gymnastics and University of Michigan State. This was the fact that they had brought these claims straight to the FBI, and the FBI both failed to act and specific agents slow-walked and engaged in misconduct in bringing those claims to where they should have gone and launching a criminal investigation of Nassar.
Yeah, I think the first complaints to the FBI were reportedly like in 2015, and then nothing happened for 15 months. How blatant was this in the eyes of the gymnasts?
Yeah, I mean, this was all kind of covered in an inspector general report that was released back in 2021.
The FBI waited weeks from the initial report to undertake any investigative activity. The FBI failed to timely interview key witnesses. The FBI failed to properly document witness statements and store evidence. The FBI failed to inform state and local authorities of Nassar's abuse when it believed the assault allegations likely did not fall within federal jurisdiction.
And Brad, when this report came out, it really looked into the actions of two FBI agents who were serving in the Indianapolis field office. It found that one of the agents actually made false statements when he was interviewed by investigators with the connection of how he handled these allegations that were brought forward.
One senior FBI official went so far as to seek a job with USA Gymnastics CEO at the same time he was overseeing the FBI's failed investigative effort.
Just these blatant examples of misconduct. And to note that the FBI would come forward multiple times to say, we are reopening this criminal investigation into these two agents to determine whether we can charge them. That's just something the FBI very rarely does. But again, this warranted in their mind such a serious breach of conduct that they had to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's important to say. Charges never filed here, which means never really an admission of wrongdoing by the agents themselves. And attorneys representing the victims have criticized that decision. So at the end of the day, though, Alex, I mean, this is more than $100 million. Dollars of taxpayer money that is going to right these clear wrongs. Is there a lesson for the FBI or the DOJ? Like, is there a bigger takeaway from any of this?
I mean, and this is not just the first time this year, Brad, that we've heard from the DOJ entering into a settlement where it's been found to have not properly conducted itself during the course of the investigation. You had that massive, you know, nearly $150 million that were paid out to victims of the 2017 shooting at the Sutherland Springs Church in Texas. You had another $127 million settlement that was paid out to victims of the Parkland High School shooting. And so obviously this, you know, the settlement now means that these claims of wrongdoing are resolved for now. These are things, though, that these victims are going to be dealing with and have been dealing with for the rest of their lives.
I'm deeply grateful. Accountability with the Justice Department has been a long time in coming. Their failures allowed over 100 children to continue being abused. But I think it's also important to recognize that this is the first step. The failures that we see happening with the FBI and the Justice Department really are just a blown-up picture of what's happening all over the country to survivors that don't have press coverage.
There's been victims of Larry Nassar who have died by suicide, we know of. Mm. And so these things are lifelong. And there's not something that you can actually put a price tag on it. We know that the FBI director, Chris Wray, who was not serving as the leader of the FBI during the time that these violations happened, he came forward with a remarkable personal apology during an appearance before Congress.
We need to remember the pain that occurred when our folks failed to do their jobs. We need to study it. We need to learn from it.
It was really striking to hear him apologize directly to the victims of Larry Nassar and how the FBI failed them. And again, this IG report did recommend a series of changes in kind of the bureaucratic handling of complaints when they're brought forward by the FBI. But it really points to just how these two FBI agents in the Indianapolis field office really stepped outside the bounds of what was proper here. And it's hard to often police that when you have a massive organization like the FBI.
Right, because you can talk about bad apples all you want, but if you're not catching the bad apples, then that's a problem with your organization. And the cost of all that to taxpayers is a distant cry from anything that these victims have faced. Alex Mallon, great work reporting on the Justice Department. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
In this country, we love to tell ourselves that we recycle. Companies tell us they're trying to get to net zero emissions. We tell our neighbors that we religiously fill up our recycling bins. But there's a big difference between saying something is getting recycled and actually recycling it. Last year, our investigative team, with the help of some of our ABC stations around the country, did a project that every other journalist, including me, wishes they had thought of first. They said, you know those bins at grocery stores that claim to recycle your plastic bags? Well, what if we stuck trackers inside some plastic bags? We put them in those bins and see if any of them actually go to recycling centers. What they found next was astonishing. Many of these trackers started popping up at landfills and incinerators. The vast majority of them never pinged anywhere near a recycling site. But some of these trackers seem to travel even farther, around the world, on a journey that some activists call waste colonialism. This week, a week of stories focusing on the power of us, Matt Gutman is back with us to walk us through these alarming discoveries. Matt, I know the reason you focused on plastic shopping bags is because they're notoriously hard to recycle compared to glass or aluminum or paper. Where do some of these plastic bags go?
Well, it really depends, but we deposited 46 trackers, Brad. 43 of them, we know, did not end up in facilities that do recycling. They were either landfilled or incinerated or somehow else disposed of. But three of them ended up on the other side of the globe, 9,000 miles away in Indonesia and Malaysia. These were three trackers that we dropped off at Walmart stores, one in New York, one in Florida, one in Kansas.
Okay, here's one of the drop-offs.
And we didn't quite expect them to wind up all the way across the world. And we knew that this had happened, but it took us some time to figure out and try to track and trace how they wound up there.
All we want to know is where you send the plastic bags that are earmarked for recycling. Like,
that's the question.
But we've been asking her for months and months. We just want to talk to people.
And what we learned is that there is a very complex, sometimes very misunderstood world of plastic exports that happens in this country. And people think that they're doing the right thing. They're trying to make the effort to deposit these plastic bags in the recycling bins that are designated for recycling. And it just doesn't always end up the way they think it does.
You said that these ended up in places like Indonesia and Malaysia. Why Malaysia?
In 2018, China banned the import of plastic. And so that's where we used to send most of our plastic for many years. And they would somehow recycle it or change it or just dump it. But China decided this was not something it wanted to keep doing and stopped it in 2018. And other countries picked up the baton. And countries like Malaysia and Indonesia started to import our plastic. The problem, Brad, is that so often the plastic that we send is not recyclable. It's plastic waste that ends up just being chucked or dumped or burned in other people's countries.
We have about 30,000 residents here, surrounded by forest, surrounded by river.
We met an activist named Puole Pang, who has been working against some of these facilities that take in the plastic and then either try to convert it to pristine plastic, to recycle it, or end up dumping it or incinerating it.
People from America, you created too much of your waste that is a problem now.
So, and she's been fighting this for years.
And more, you see? Italy, Ireland.
And she showed us the backs of the facilities where they are allegedly dumping plastic waste right into rivers.
So this is how they dump their waste. And then this is just in the backyard of the factory.
The plastic fragments of our trash sometimes ends up in the very fabric of the soil, on leaves, on blades of grass, just sort of enmeshed in the nature there of what used to be this pristine jungle.
We have a broken system. We are not as capable as your people think that we can handle your waste.
So it was pretty jarring to see the result of what happens when we try to recycle plastic in this country and where it ends up. And not just that, but think about it. What is the carbon footprint of trying to send a shipment of plastic 9,000 miles away?
When you're going to put it in a landfill anyway. You're just spending all that extra CO2 to do it.
Exactly. I mean, our analysis of shipping data estimates that shipping all that plastic 9,000 miles away, round Africa, up to Asia, pumped more than 100,000 metric tons of CO2 in the atmosphere just over the past 3 years. And this is just for shipping plastic.
Wait, and so just so I'm getting it right, Matt, is like, why are these companies taking all this plastic if it's not going to be recyclable? Is it just the idea that companies here in the U.S. are so desperate to get rid of it that they're like, yeah, if you're recycling it, we'll pay you to take it off our hands. And so there are companies around the world being like, great, you'll pay us. Who knows what happens to it after that, but we'll take your money for sure.
Yeah, and some of them actually want the plastic. If it is the kind of quality plastic that can be recycled, it's valuable. The problem is a lot of the plastic is contaminated and it's of poor quality, which means it ends up having to be incinerated or dumped. And so what we found, Brad, is that some of these companies, according to data that we got from the Malaysian parliament, says that at least one of these companies that our trackers went to does not have a license to import, apparently. Another one of the companies does have a license to import. But the question is, you know, this is a gray zone at times of where this plastic ends up, who ends up buying it, and what they end up doing with it. The bottom line is, American consumers who think they're doing the right thing by dropping off their perfectly pristine and clean plastic bags at plastic bag recycling bins at countless big box stores across the country, they don't know that the vast majority of what they're dropping in does not end up getting recycled. In fact, some of it gets shipped thousands of miles away, possibly to be dumped in another country's backyard.
Right. And I know the thing you've been driving home has been like, it's not like recycling doesn't work. It's specific so often to plastic, basically, and especially plastic bags. Is the moral of the story then, Matt, on the U.S. side of this, that they are like, what are the companies doing about it? Are they fine essentially sending this stuff off just so that they're able to say it's been recycled? Or are they genuinely in the dark that this is just ending up in the backyard of like this activist?
I think that's unclear. What we do know is that we've been trying to ask Walmart these very questions for a year and a half, and they have declined our request for interviews.
Let's get time to talk about this. I'd love to learn more about...
Well, we have a room actually right here if you would come.
I'm sorry.
We actually went to a conference where we found Walmart's chief sustainability officer and asked these very questions.
We've been trying to for over a year now, and we've been flatly rejected by your team.
Okay.
So I wonder if you would go on the record, because this is important.
And she said, oh yeah, email me. Let's sit down. Let's do an interview. And of course, we did just that. We planned an interview. They offered a date. We said, okay, we'll be there. And then just a few days before, they canceled that date and they didn't answer any of our specific questions about plastic recycling and then just sent us a statement from the company. And they basically said that they strive to do the right thing, noting that their program isn't perfect, but they said it does provide recycling access to millions of customers. They also said they're changing some of what they do, that they're continuously improving their recycling, including new contracts requiring companies to prove that collected materials are recycled as much as practicable.
The challenge will be to bring some pretty disparate groups together. There are some groups that believe that we should basically keep producing what you produce and recycle your way out of the problem.
So if you poll all of the consultants and everybody working on the plastic pollution problem, the one thing pretty much everybody agrees upon is that the only way to truly stop the plastic pollution problem is to cap the production of new plastic, basically make less of it.
It sounds like you're saying something kind of novel for the U.S. government. It sounds like you're willing to accept putting limits and capping the production of new plastic
products.
Not necessarily.
But a representative of the U.S. government, a senior-level diplomat for the State Department, who is working on this possibly historic U.N. treaty on plastic pollution, told us that the U.S. government is not going to put a cap on plastic production.
such a bizarre industry with tentacles, like you said, all over the world. This special, by the way, called Trashed, The Secret Life of Plastic Exports, premiered on ABC News Live last night. It is streaming on Hulu right now this morning. Matt Gutman, our chief national correspondent, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, imagine if a Yankees pitcher was told, we'll pay you this year as long as you never play for the Red Sox ever. Well, maybe you've already signed a contract like this. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. This country might soon have a lot more free agents.
The motion passes 3-2.
Yesterday, the Federal Trade Commission voted to do something it's talked about for more than a year: ban the practice of non-compete clauses for American employees. A non-compete clause in your contract means you can't go to work for a rival company, sometimes even after your current employment has ended. Like if you work at a tech firm, you might not be able to go work at another one for a year or two. The idea is simple. The Coca-Colas of the world don't want their employees heading to Pepsi with a secret recipe. But this has become about a lot more than trade secrets and chief engineers.
When you got this lawsuit, what was your reaction?
I was shocked. This is the demand letter I got.
ABC has spoken to employees who have been sued by their former employers when they're not walking out the door with any proprietary knowledge. More and more often, they say, these clauses are used to simply dissuade employees from leaving for a better salary.
People think this is about folks in the boardroom, but it's not. It's also about hairstylists. It's about security guards, people all across the income spectrum.
At this point, the FTC estimates one in five Americans has signed some sort of non-compete clause. Some are fast food workers. Even small businesses have started putting this in their contracts.
We follow what the big boys do, and if they put non-competes, we'll do non-competes.
Which is why yesterday, Chairwoman Lina Khan announced that 120 days from now, no new contracts can include provisions like this anywhere in the country. Even existing non-compete clauses will be null and void for the vast majority of employees.
This rule in particular could affect workers' livelihoods and the viability of small businesses and startups. And so it was especially important to me that we be able to provide some additional visibility and public accountability.
She says thousands of workers will now be able to start their own businesses that compete with their old ones. Fairer competition will raise salaries, and since so many of these non-competes are for healthcare workers, healthcare costs for the rest of us could even go down. There's already legal pushback here, so much, in fact, that the 120-day waiting period could just be the beginning. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the pro-business group in D.C., says this will hurt businesses and employees because the sense of trust will be gone.
Employees today are often exposed to things that, while may not be technically trade secrets, really are kind of the secret sauce for how a company's going to operate.
But employees who say they're routinely pressured to sign these contracts with little negotiation say there wasn't a ton of trust in the first place. And if this rule goes through, you can trust they'll be looking at all their options. The FTC also said a current contract can stand if the employee is a senior executive. I got a feeling a lot of people are about to find out their companies consider them senior executives, even if they don't get paid like it. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.